KBOO is currently running a Kickstarter campaign to build a city of media makers. From February 8th to March 9th, you can become a media maker and help spread the word. Just go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter between now and March 9th to join.
Broadcasts that not only keep you informed, but are informing the next generation. Here's what some of our listeners are saying. From Ron F., a longtime KBU member, I was able to catch about 45 minutes of your broadcast, and the second I heard it, all of me got stopped. The sound was thrilling, and it kept being thrilling. And when the next piece came on, it was also thrilling. What you were doing reached all the way down. I felt woke up and alive. From an anonymous KBU supporter, I'm a longtime KBU supporter. Thank you for being the only real radio station. From Joe Becker, a disaster prep specialist and guest, thank you for the chance to share and for shepherding me through the process of being live on KBU and making me as comfortable as possible. And from local grassroots organization Asians for Black Lives, thank you for having us on the evening news. We appreciate your support and for the opportunity to amplify our message. Join us on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBU Build a City of Media Makers, and thank you for your support of KBU.
KBU Radio trains media makers. We believe community resilience happens when citizens know how to make their own media. For the last 50 years, KBU has trained thousands of citizen journalists to report on what goes on in the streets of Portland and far beyond. We know that with our expertise and your support, we can keep this city activated and aware through radio. Invest in Portland's future media makers and join KBU on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBU Build a City of Media Makers. And thank you for your support of KBU.
Help us help you keep Portland weird. Join Contessa de la Luna of the World Famous Confessional for the 6th annual Contessa de la Luna Valentine Spectacular and Fashion Show. We're giving away a $100 cash prize plus live performances by Contessa de la Luna. Get your weird on and bring a date. Advance tickets available at Brown Paper Tickets. All proceeds benefit your community radio station, KBOO. That's Thursday, February 15th, 7 to 9:45 p.m. Feel the love of your other Contessa de la Lunatics. Contessa de la Luna's Valentine Spectacular, Thursday, February 15th at the Clinton Street Theater, 7 p.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is now 5:01 p.m. Up next is your Tuesday evening news. And we have launched our Kickstarter campaign. KBOO's Kickstarter campaign needs your support today to help build a strong infrastructure for the next generation of culture workers and DJs. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter. And we'd like to thank the following individuals who have donated to KBOO's Kickstarter: Kate, Selena, Patrick, Jane, and Bill. We thank you so much.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Kate Brown pardons Dondre Fair.
A climber has been rescued from a fall on Mount Hood.
And in international news, South Korea's cryptocurrency is exceeding the level exchange on the international market. Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 13th, 2018. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Jasmine. Yesterday, Governor Kate Brown granted a pardon to Dondre Chu Fair, a 44-year-old former gang member turned community leader fighting against gang violence. In 1992, Fair served a 5-year prison sentence for armed robbery. For decades, his felony conviction held him back from stable employment, volunteering at Portland elementary schools, and even attending field trips with his children. In an interview with Oregon Live, Fair described his pardon grant as, quote, a house being lifted off my back. Growing up in Northeast Portland during the height of the city's crack cocaine epidemic, Fair experienced the difficulties involved with breaking the cycle of drugs and gang violence. He severed his gang ties in 2000, and in 2009 began to mentor young men in Portland through Volunteers of America. Along with building strong relationships with the young men, he helped them look for housing and land job interviews. By drawing on his past experiences, Fair can meaningfully connect with the young men he mentors. Jamari Herring, a 22-year-old who recently completed Fair's mentorship program, gave Oregon Live an account of his experience, saying, "He comes from where we come from. What he says and does is real." Although many are celebrating Fair's pardon, criminal justice reform advocates note that this pardon is not enough. Aliza Kaplan, Fair's lawyer for his pardoning petition, believes that Governor Brown should exercise her power more to address Oregon's insidious history of racial disparities and harsh prison sentences in the criminal justice system.
This afternoon, a rescue helicopter reached a group of climbers on Mount Hood after one fell an estimated 700 to 1,000 feet. According to the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, the climber fell in the Hogsback area around 10:30 a.m. This popular climbing route begins at an elevation of 10,500 feet and leads to Mount Hood's summit. Three fellow climbers performed CPR until the helicopter arrived. As many as 15 other climbers are still stranded on the mountain. About 40 rescuers were on the scene this afternoon from a variety of volunteer agencies, including Portland Mountain Rescue and 304th Air Force Rescue Squad. Rough weather is expected on the mountain tomorrow at 1 a.m., which could impact rescue efforts if they continue into the night. Clackamas County Sheriff Sergeant Brian Jensen described the mountain's conditions to Kattu News as, quote, treacherous. Fallen rock and ice litter the mountain when it freezes overnight and warms drastically during the day. Rescue crew members expressed that it is tough to tell how many climbers will be in need of help as the mountain's conditions continue to change with the unusually warm daytime weather. The fallen climber was flown to Legacy Emanuel Hospital, and his name or current condition have remained unreleased.
According to Business Korea and Fortune magazine, in a stark contrast to South Korea's previous approach to Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, the country is loosening its firm approach and creating a licensing system to assist in the regulation of the country's digital exchanges. One prototype South Korea has been considering is based on the BitLicense model developed in New York. The BitLicense system only allows exchanges that have applied for a license from New York State's Department of Financial Services to trade cryptocurrencies and enforces meticulous reporting regulations and a minimum capital requirement, essentially limiting the number of firms and digital monies that qualify. South Korea's new management-minded approach designed to bring cryptocurrency into a more traditional model of currency is a big turnaround from its energetic crackdown on digital exchanges last year, which saw virtual currencies trade for higher than international levels. The Korean government responded quickly by establishing more restrictive measures early in 2017 to root out anonymous transactions and allow for more freedom to curtail digital exchanges. The price of Bitcoin, currently the world's largest digital currency, dropped 12% last month. Investors say that the dip is connected to fears that South Korea would ban virtual trading completely.
Which came first, hard currency or the ledger? You don't have to answer that, but no matter the answer, physical currency or the hard copy tally of debts and payments has been the sole form of money used in human history. Today, physical cash is increasingly being replaced with cashless systems, including cryptocurrencies. Several citizens of countries including Japan, South Korea, North Korea, Russia, and the United States have been investing heavily in cryptocurrency, urging some countries to quickly push through laws to regulate the digital money flow. At the same time, banks across the globe are beginning to take a closer look at cryptocurrency themselves, with some saying 2018 will be the year we can expect banks to invest a noticeable amount of their money in digital currency and decentralized ledgers like blockchain. In this three-part series brought to you by Making Contact at radioproject.org, we hear from blockchain researcher Jaya Clara Brekke on the political economy of blockchain and the protocols of consensus. First, we go to Athens, where Nikki Seth Smith and Alyssa Moxley look at how some Greeks have been using cryptocurrencies since banking restrictions were imposed in 2015.
This week on Making Contact, what came first, coin or the ledger, is unclear, but physical currency and a written tally of debts and payments have been the two primary forms of currency used throughout history. Today, physical cash is increasingly being replaced with cashless systems, including cryptocurrencies. On this episode of Making Contact, we'll hear from a blockchain researcher about an ethical framework she created for developers of blockchain. But first, we go to Athens, Greece, where Making Contact contributors Nikki Seth Smith and Alyssa Moxley look at how some Greeks have been using cryptocurrencies since banking restrictions were imposed in 2015.
The Greeks, they don't trust the Greek governments, not this one. All the governments, I think, from 2010 till today. So I think capital controls will stay here, because if they remove capital controls, everyone will get their money to their beds or to send it to other countries or somewhere else.
It's not surprising that many Greeks have lost trust in both the state and the banks. The Greek economy has been in meltdown since 2010, when the country's huge public debt was revealed. Multiple bailouts have come at a cost, with Greeks suffering high unemployment, low wages, and terrible public services. They've lost control of their own finances, with the country's European creditors demanding higher taxes and putting huge pressure on the Greek banking system.
You don't trust the Greek governments, nothing can change, because you need to trust the governments for keep your money in the banks or bring it back to Greece.
Some are looking outside the national system for alternative ways of dealing with money. They have found an alternative: cryptocurrencies. These are forms of digital money that use cryptography for security. Because they're not issued by a central authority, they can exist outside government control. Taverna Agala seems at first like a typical Greek restaurant. In one of the western suburbs of Athens, it serves simple food like grilled meats and salads.
It's a family restaurant. We rent about 21 years now with my father.
But Nikos decided to shake things up a little.
I use Bitcoin in the restaurant from 2013. We have a 10% discount for people who pay with Bitcoin. We don't have prices with Bitcoin in the price. Every day change.
Bitcoin's value has increased more than 50 times since 2013. But it's not just about making a profit. Cryptocurrencies are maintained by crypto miners around the world. They're global. That means they remain above Greek law that might affect the banking system here. In fact, so far, no laws exist around their use in Greece. Holding digital currency gives Nikos a backup plan if something goes wrong with his Greek bank account. Since the crisis, Greeks have struggled to pay their taxes. Here, if you owe money to the state, the authorities are legally obliged to freeze your bank account. In the first half of 2017, roughly 900 bank accounts were frozen or their assets seized every day.
In one day, when they see you have debt and that debt have passed 30 days without paid, then they get in your bank accounts and froze it. And they don't care if you have to pay employees, if you have to pay rent, if you have to pay for your kids to feed them. They don't care for that. They just get it.
I actually had this issue with my personal account. I owed to the tax authorities some charges. It was decided that they were unfair. So eventually I got them back, but it was something worth 6,000 euros. Suddenly one day I found my account frozen with no money in it. I couldn't even get 20 euros from the ATM. So at that time I had to convert Bitcoin into euros from my friends and work with cash.
That's Theonisis Zendros, who came to the restaurant to have dinner. He's a blockchain PhD student at the University of Athens, looking at issues of trading and trust.
So I got some Ethereum. You wanna bring the check, please?
Theonisis is paying with Ethereum, which is now, after Bitcoin, the second largest cryptocurrency in the world. It's the first time that the Taverna has taken another kind of crypto coin. Theonisis is familiar with lots of cryptocurrencies, and Nikos is happy to expand his trade.
In Ethereum, yes, it's the first try.
I have three confirmations. So Ethereum is much faster than Bitcoin. Three.
They compare DigiWallets and make sure the transaction has gone through.
Oh, and that is here. Okay. So thanks a lot.
There are hundreds of cryptocurrencies, and new ones are created all the time. While they work in different ways, all make use of blockchain technology to avoid passing through a central bank. This puts power in the hands of the people who run and use them, rather than a national banking system. While speculation and investment have been driving forces of their growth, some people use them for practical reasons. For others, it's an ethical choice.
So I would consider myself an anarchist. Maybe you can say digital anarchist, because we seek to use technical means to achieve independence and allow each to govern their own self when it comes to money, when it comes to law. The core concept is decentralization. By decentralization, we mean permissionless systems. which is a system that anyone can join without the requirement of an authority to allow them to join the system.
It's difficult to open an account here in the first place. Greek bureaucracy is notorious, but the economic crisis has made it even harder for many to meet the bank's requirements, especially as proof of employment is essential. Given that one in four Greeks are unemployed, many families share an account.
So with decentralized cryptocurrencies and permissionless cryptocurrencies, the hope was that we could bank the unbanked and bring the ability to use money to anyone in the world, regardless of their government and regardless of the political will of the politicians and regardless of whether there are banks and institutions that wish to allow them in. And that means there can be no capital controls. There can be no haircuts on people's money because there are no banks and governments to take the money because there are no bank accounts.
When Dionysus says haircuts, he's talking about the devaluation of savings. While this hasn't happened yet in Greece, the prospect is a constant fear. In nearby Cyprus, more than 4 billion euros were slashed from private savings accounts back in 2013 to meet the debt repayment demands of the country's European creditors. Only the wealthiest were targeted. Still, they lost more than a third of their holdings over and above 100,000 euros. They never got their money back.
But even if I have some savings in euros and it's sitting at a Greek bank and I don't know if it's ever going to be available to me, I don't know if it's even going to be haircut, right?
Even if someone does have a bank account, there are serious restrictions on how they can use it. Capital controls have been in place since 2015 to stop people from taking large amounts of money out of the country. At first, account holders could take only 60 euros a day. Now it's relaxed a bit, and users can withdraw or transfer up to 1,800 a month. It's still limiting, though. Imagine if you're a Greek person with 20,000 euros in savings. If you wanted to move abroad, it might take you more than a year to bring that money with you.
I think capital controls is a big issue. Bitcoin is one way, and other coins, of course, are a way to move capital from Greece to elsewhere, and also to pay for services. I personally know people that have done it. I've even helped people do it in a legal way. In my research team, we get paid in Bitcoin partially. So for conference reimbursements or for travel reimbursements, I personally get paid in Bitcoin. If you want to move money from Greece to Switzerland and back, just to do business, not even to save, this is a useful way to do it.
Cryptocurrency can help ordinary people work around these issues. But what are people actually using crypto coins for in Greece? Dionysus uses forums to trade in cryptocurrencies with people online and face-to-face. He has had some interesting encounters.
I had put up ads that were selling and buying Bitcoin at almost market price, just because I wanted to involve more Greeks and to meet more people and to encourage people to use it. And this guy sends me a message on local Bitcoin and he says, oh, you know, I want to meet up. I don't have a phone and my name is Nico. And that's all he said. I gave him the Bitcoin, he gives me the cash, and I try to like open up some conversation, like, why are you interested in Bitcoin? And he's like, that's none of your business. He leaves.
Because users don't have to give any personal identification, cryptocurrencies naturally attract people who want privacy. This can be legit, or it can be criminal. In the summer of 2017, a Russian mastermind accused of laundering $4 billion worth of Bitcoin was arrested in a northern Greek village. He was involved in drug trafficking, fraud, and identity theft, among other crimes. It's actually impossible to know who in Greece is using Bitcoin and for what purpose. But there is a community that seeks to use cryptocurrency within an ethical code, while still protecting its users' privacy.
Faircoin was introduced here 2 years ago.
Faircoin calls itself the cooperative version of Bitcoin. While 10% is on the open market, the coin is mainly used within the global Fair Co-op ecosystem, which aims to move towards a fairer world and economy.
The board of directors at Lewis and Clark College voted today to join with Oregon State University, the University of Oregon Foundation, and Western Oregon University to divest from fossil fuels. Last spring, the board was petitioned by a group called Students Engaged in Economic Defense, or SEED, to divest. At that time, the board agreed not to make any new investments in the fossil fuel industry, but today's announcement to completely divest by the year 2023 was greeted by SEED with extreme pleasure. Lewis and Clark has long been known to be a leader in the green movement, and last year it received the number 5 spot on the Sierra Club's list of cool schools. Globally, more than 800 institutions have divested from fossil fuels, amounting to over $6 trillion in lost revenue to the industry. Educational institutions account for about 1/6 of that amount.
Donald Trump's budget proposal that was released on Monday includes a plan to cut the food stamp program by over $213 billion over the next 10 years. The proposal calls for replacing half the monthly cash benefit, which is currently around $125 per person, with a Department of Agriculture food box containing, and I quote, shelf-stable milk, ready-to-eat cereals, pasta, peanut butter, beans, and canned fruit, vegetables, and meat, poultry, or fish. The boxes would not contain fresh produce or meat. The proposal claims that this approach will be cost-effective, but with the costs of packing and delivery, this seems unlikely. The budget proposal also claims the boxes will likely improve the nutritional value of the benefits, but fails to provide any evidence backing this claim.
The family of Quanis Hayes recently announced that they will be suing the city of Portland as well as the police officers involved in shooting Quanis just over a year ago on February 9th. The Hayes family has also been active at the grassroots level over the last year and held multiple events over the anniversary weekend. KABU reporter Sam Bowman attended a protest in East Portland on Saturday and had this report.
On Saturday, a group of protesters gathered on Southeast 106th Avenue to mark the one-year anniversary of the killing of 17-year-old Quanis Hayes by a Portland police officer. Friday, the 9th of February, was the exact anniversary, and the Hayes family held a candlelit memorial in the area where Hayes was shot, on Northeast 82nd Avenue. On Saturday, the family and several dozen supporters gathered for a very different reason: to call out the police and the local criminal justice system for failing to hold the officer who shot Quanis responsible. I got there as about 40 people were setting up on the side of the road.
We're here at 737 Southeast 106th, out in East Portland, across the street from the East Portland Community Policing Center, which is part of the Police Bureau's East Precinct.
This event appeared to have input from a number of community groups, but was largely coordinated by the Hayes family, including Quanis' mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother.
There's a few families, it looks like, walking up with signs. People are putting signs up against the bushes across the street from the precinct. They say, "Moose, you are loved and missed." Moose is Quanis Hayes' nickname. Police plus AR-15 equal murder. Moose was shot by an officer with an AR-15 rifle. Said he had a fake gun on him, though in the grand jury testimony, none of the officers involved admitted to seeing it at any point.
Officer Andrew Hurst shot Quanis Hayes at short range with the rifle, hitting him 3 times in the torso and head. As the protest got underway, Quanis' grandmother Donna questioned Hurst's assumption that the 17-year-old, who was suspected of committing an armed robbery earlier in the night, was armed. She's speaking here into a microphone hooked up to a portable speaker, and during much of this speech, children and family members pressed against the locked front door of the precinct building, looking in. People inside would occasionally come to the door, but never came out, and at no point were any police even seen, except for a few passing cars.
If Hurst on duty today, tell him to come out here and talk to me. We'd like to know what he see that nobody else sees. You were surrounded by a whole lot of police officers, and only one shot. I know when you all fear for your life, y'all do it in bunches. So why did he do it? Because he didn't see anything. Do you think we slow? I'm just curious. Do you? Come on, tell me about it. I mean, he was surrounded, you know. Nobody didn't see anything in his waistband. Come on out here. Isn't this community policing? Here go the community. Come on and talk to us. You have the community waiting. Hey, David, are you in there? We know you or Brian is in there.
Donna Hayes said she's using the officers' first names only out of a lack of respect. but presumably she is referring to Captain David Golladay of the East Precinct and East Precinct Commander Brian Parman. Neither came outside during the protest, and it's unclear if they were in the building at all.
I bet you if I threw a brick through that window, you'd come a-running. But I'm not a criminal. I'm just a woman looking for answers. Come on and talk to us. Or do you fear for your life?
An hour into the protest, at 4 p.m., there were well over 75 people gathered across from the precinct. No representative from the Portland Police Bureau engaged the crowd at any time, but had they would have walked out the front door and seen children writing dozens of names in big letters on the sidewalk in multicolored chalk, with a big heart around each. They were the names of those killed by police and white supremacy in Portland, in Oregon, and in the greater Northwest, from the relatively familiar names chanted at Portland protests to those less known, but just as fervently remembered by their own families, and by a growing grassroots movement to hold police and prosecutors responsible for civilian deaths.
Folks are putting signs up on all the poles in front of the precinct and up and down the street. They have a picture of Quanis Hayes and District Attorney Rod Underhill. Rod Underhill is not capitalized. Hold police accountable. Stop killing our children. Stand up against police brutality. Yellow signs, very visible. You can see them fluttering down the street.
By 4:30, the names written in chalk filled the sidewalk for the length of the community policing building, and were still being written. Sam Bowman, KBOO, Portland. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Preference at 6. That's followed at 7 by Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, a low temperature of 37 degrees is expected, and look for showers on Valentine's Day with a high of 50 degrees and another low of 37. Today in history, a 1945 Allied Air Forces firebombed the German city of Dresden. In what became one of the most controversial episodes of the war, author Kurt Vonnegut wrote about the incident from his own life in the book Slaughterhouse-Five. The quote of the day is also from Kurt Vonnegut, who said, quote, "The arts are not a way to make a living. They are a very human way of making life more bearable. Practicing an art, no matter how well or badly, is a way to make your soul grow for heaven's sake."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
I had a really
The fallout is continuing over last week's controversial verdict in the shooting death of a First Nations man in Canada. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the family of the victim has traveled to Ottawa to meet with federal officials, including the Prime Minister.
The family of 22-year-old Colton Bushy say they want justice, either an appeal of the not guilty verdict for the Saskatchewan farmer who shot him, or an inquiry into the verdict. Bushy was shot and killed when he and several friends went to the farm of Gerald Stanley. Stanley's lawyer said the killing was a freak accident and the jury acquitted him. What followed was anger and outrage across the country as Indigenous groups and their supporters held rallies and vigils over the weekend, demanding justice. First Nations politicians are calling for action and say that the rallies across the country were a powerful message that justice should be for all, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. Manitoba Grand Chief Sheila North Wilson says Indigenous people should have more representation in Canada's justice system.
This is an example of what happens when we don't include the perspectives of Indigenous people of this land in every case. And unfortunately, this is a sad reality that many people have come across. We're hearing about this one because it's an extreme case, but there are other cases like it across Canada, and we have to change that going forward.
In Ottawa, the Minister of Justice, Jody Wilson-Raybould, says the government will be reviewing the jury selection process to make sure Native people are not being left out. She says she wants to move quickly with those reforms. Meanwhile, the Bushy family has met with federal ministers, and today they are meeting with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The president of the National Congress of American Indians, Jefferson Keel, delivered the 16th annual State of Indian Nations address on Monday. As Congress works through its agenda this year, the tribal leader wants people in Indian country to remember their power at the ballot box. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
In his State of the Union address, President Donald Trump hailed the Republican tax plan and doubled down on his calls for a border wall. But he never mentioned the needs of Indian country. That comes after 8 years of President Barack Obama using the annual address to at least briefly mention the needs of Indian country. In his tribal address, President Jefferson Keel said Trump's agenda doesn't seem to include tribes.
Indian country's top priorities were absent from the version the president signed in December. That is completely unacceptable.
Trump is calling for a massive infrastructure bill that could cost as much as $1.5 trillion, which Keel says must include a recognition of tribal sovereignty and the need for investments in Indian country.
These projects are often in rural areas. They connect tribal and surrounding communities with each other and with the rest of the nation. Tribal infrastructure is American infrastructure. In 2018, no infrastructure bill should pass unless it includes Indian country's priorities.
Democratic Senator Tom Udall from New Mexico gave this year's congressional response. While Trump could prove an impediment to passing Indian country's priorities, Udall reassured tribal leaders that in Congress, there's still a bipartisan commitment to working with sovereign tribes.
Decisions made for Indians by Indians produce the best outcomes for the unique needs, cultures, and beliefs of their communities.
President Keel reiterated that this fall, the Indian vote needs to be loud and responsive to policy decisions made over the next year.
Elected officials must hear our voices and heed our priorities, because we will be watching and we will be voting.
For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
After over a year of investigations, Israeli police officials state that there exists sufficient evidence to indict Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on cases of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. According to Israeli news source Haaretz, police officials recommend that Mr. Netanyahu face prosecution based on two corruption cases. The first corruption investigation, called Case 1000, alleges that the Prime Minister received hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of illicit gifts from billionaire benefactors. These gifts included jewelry, cigars, and champagne, which he and his wife Sarah willfully accepted. One of these benefactors is Israeli-born Hollywood producer Arnon Milchan, whose amount of gifts increased significantly once Netanyahu became Prime Minister, according to Israeli police officials. Netanyahu claims that these gifts were a token of their friendship, but the investigation uncovers that these lavish gifts were given in return for political favors. One example of these alleged political favors includes Netanyahu helping Milchan receive a new 10-year visa to the United States. The second corruption investigation, called Case 2000, involves a suspected quid pro quo deal between Netanyahu and Yedioth Ahronoth newspaper publisher Arnon Moses. This deal would lead Netanyahu to limit the circulation of a rival paper, Israel Hayom. In return, Yedioth Ahronoth would give Netanyahu more favorable news coverage. The police discovered that Netanyahu even called lawmakers to his house one weekend to discuss legislation that would benefit Moses. Prime Minister Netanyahu dismisses the police recommendations as, quote, unfounded and slander, and claims that the investigation is extremely biased. The Times of Israel reports that the police recommendations will now go to Attorney General Avishai Mandelblit, who will ultimately decide whether or not to indict Netanyahu on the charges.
The South African government has declared the drought in Cape Town a national disaster. The little rain that fell over the city this past weekend, the first since January 22nd, did little to add water to the city's reservoir, which is dangerously low. It did, however, push back day zero, the day when the taps in the city are expected to run dry, from April 12th to June 4th. Cape Town officials have also announced new water-saving measures that require residents to use less than 50 liters a day. That's about enough for a two-minute shower, one flush of the toilet, 2 liters of drinking water, and 2 liters to cook with. As the rain fell this weekend, people rushed to the streets, collecting water in buckets from the gutters to use for washing and toilets. If day zero is reached without any relief, water rationing will be cut back to just 25 liters per person, and would have to be collected at water stations, of which there will be only 200 in a city of 4 million residents. Institutions such as hospitals and schools are expected to continue to receive water. A group that has been evaluating Portland's officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths is holding a community listening session tomorrow, and you are cordially invited to attend. I spoke with Mike Giannacco, the OIR group's founding principal, this afternoon. The OIR group was contracted by the Portland City Auditor in 2010 to evaluate the investigation of the death of James Chassie. Following that report, the group began conducting annual investigations into the use of deadly force by the Portland Police Bureau. Their most recent report was released last week and examined 6 deadly force cases that occurred between 2014 and 2015. Mike Giannacco is one of the founding principals of the OIR group. He will be presenting the group's 2018 report to the Portland City Council on Thursday, but before that, he is hosting a community listening session. The session is open to the general public and will be attended by representatives of the Independent Police Review and the Citizen Review Committee. Mr. Giannacco was at KABU today to discuss his mission, his work, and the importance of community involvement in the process of police reform. The hour and a half conversation has been edited for clarity and to fit into this broadcast. Mike started his professional career as a teacher. He then decided to go to law school.
After graduating from law school, I went to work for the Civil Rights Division in Washington, D.C. My work there was primarily, it started out as voting discrimination cases in the Deep South and Indian country. And then after a couple years, I moved on and was involved in criminal investigations of official misconduct, which was primarily looking at potential prosecutions of police officers and other public officials for violating constitutional rights. I did that throughout the country for about 8 years and then moved to Los Angeles and continued to work in the Central California area for another 6 years.
In 2001, he started the OIR group, providing oversight to the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, the largest in the country. Since then, he has worked with about 40 agencies around the country, including Portland. He says he started the OIR group to work towards police reform at the systemic level.
The work that I had done with the Department of Justice, where police officers were looking at a potential prosecution federally for excessive force or filing false police reports, was essentially a nuclear option that we had. But that's all the tools that we had was the prosecution. And when we were, when I was looking at conduct of officers who are now targets of a federal investigation, it was almost always the case that looking at their previous history, that there had been warning signs or actual misconduct that had gone under-addressed or unaddressed by the agency itself. So when I had the opportunity to move over to oversee a large agency like the Sheriff's Department, I lost the nuclear option, but I also was given a lot more tools on ways to address misconduct, whether it was through formal discipline, termination, discharge, counseling, training, guidance. I just had a whole lot more tools available to me as an overseer of an agency. And my view is that we could be more effective catching misconduct on the front end rather than waiting until misconduct had really become very egregious.
You were initially contracted by the auditor's office. Who are the stakeholders in the work that you're doing for the city?
Our contract's with the auditor's office, obviously, and so they are our clients, if we wanted to specifically define one. But my view and the reason I'm doing this work is because I think I have a greater responsibility when I'm involved in these assignments, and really that responsibility begins and ends with a greater community of the city in which I've been asked to do the work. With the idea, again, of ensuring that there is accountability when there isn't, pointing that out, and when there are gaps in the investigation, pointing those out, when there is insufficiently robust review, identifying that, and then most importantly, telling that to the public in a way that's readable, understandable, and doesn't pull any punches.
What do you think success looks like? What do you think progress looks like? Have we seen any tangible progress?
I think it's slow, but and gradual, at least with regard to the way in which the Bureau conducts itself and reviews its deadly force incidents, which are important. It's important to do in comparison to reviews that other agencies do. Portland is significantly ahead, I think, as a result, a large result of the fact that we've been involved in pushing on that. And other oversight groups throughout the city have also been involved in pushing on that. And I think it has made a difference. One of the things that we are able to have the most impact on, of course, is the Bureau itself. Because our reports are the council and the mayor ultimately has authority in the city to move the department forward, move the Bureau forward in a positive direction.
In your experience, what is the role of the community, specifically in Portland, in overseeing discipline, evaluating police conduct and misconduct, and having a place at the table in conversations about change?
I think in any community, it's important for the community to be involved in and have a voice, a meaningful voice, in the way in which public safety operates in the community. That's particularly so in Portland because of the level of engagement that we see here. It's clear to us that of the various cities that we work with, Portland is near the top with regard to that level of engagement and the expectations that the city and the city residents have in ensuring that they do have a voice at the table. The word rocket ship is older in our vernacular than police oversight. So it really shows you how new this idea is. It's been 50 years, maybe, that there's been even talk of oversight and engagement and involvement and having a voice in the way in which the police decide how to police a city. But in 50 years, there have been significant strides, particularly in this city. Overlay over overlay of oversight has been accepted, sometimes grudgingly so, I would say, by the Bureau, but been accepted and is now part of the fabric of the city. Yeah, is it perfect? No. Can it get better? Absolutely. Has it made a difference? I believe it has. And I think if you look at the way in which deadly force incidents are now reviewed, again, as indicated in our reports, they're not perfect, but they're certainly better than they would have been had there not been oversight. So I'm optimistic. I think that more needs to be done. I think that the community needs to continue to be involved and make decisions about how policing is going to happen in the city. Because of our assignment, we only are able to look at a slice of police conduct, that is the times in which police use deadly force. There's a whole lot of other activity that police do in Portland. It's the rare case in which deadly force is used. Most officers never use deadly force in America in their whole careers. So we are taking a look at an important but very small slice of police activity. But, you know, the broader discussion, and I think an important discussion going on in Portland and needs to continue in Portland, is whether or not what police are doing is consistent with the community's expectations about what they should be doing. Do we want to continue to have police responding to calls for service, responding in traditional ways, focusing on citations and arrests, which is traditionally the way in which policing has been going on in this country? Or do we want to shift to community policing, to procedural justice, to problem solving, to community policing in the reformative way? And if we do, how do we incentivize that? How do we incentivize officers to do that? And I think more work needs to be done there.
Community members who would like to participate in the conversation about police oversight in Portland are encouraged to attend the OIR listening session tomorrow at 2 p.m. in the Rose Room at City Hall. The group's 2018 report on officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths can be found on the right side of the Independent Police Review website at www.portlandoregon.gov/IPR. This is Jasmine Moneymaker, KBU News.
Next, it's the moment you've all been waiting for, your weekly word riddle. It's time for the point puzzle.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to take the name of an Olympic movie, remove any letters found in Pyeongchang, and then remove the duplicates, and the letters that are left can spell first. Well, the answer is the movie Chariots of Fire. Our winner this week is Judy Lowell, who listens to KSER in Everett, Washington. For the new puzzle, I'm looking for three things that you can make out of snow. Each is a five-letter word, and they all share two consonants. As a bonus, between them, they use all five vowels, A, E, I, O, and U. So again, I'm looking for three things that you can make out of snow. Each is a five-letter word, and they share two consonants. Between them, they use each of the five vowels at least once. When you know the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of February 12th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV High Desert Community Radio.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman, Miranda Krause, Al Kahn, and Jasmine Moneymaker. The producer is Zelos Marchant. Our engineer is Wesley, the potentiometer, Seway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. KBOO is in a special Kickstarter drive. Visit us on Kickstarter and donate to the next generation of media makers. KBOO has been growing media makers for 50 years, and you can become a part of the revolution of community media. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jasmine.
And I'm Sam. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Back from a 9-day trip to South Dakota for High Country News, Jacqueline Keeler talks about the cases of Red Fawn and Olivia Lone Bear. That's Wednesday Talk Radio tomorrow at 8. At 9, Political Perspectives presents On the Ground Radio and an interview with Gerald Horn on his new book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Dirt Bag, Glenn Anderson answers your garden questions and updates his project to breed apricots west of the Cascades. KBOO's Kickstarter is live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and help KBOO build a city of media makers. That's you, and that's kboo.fm/Kickstarter. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Jasmine Moneymaker.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night, Wesley.
Well, good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Last spring, KBOO News reported on Oregon State University's plans to demolish the Corvallis Multicultural Center, also known as Sunflower House, on its campus in order to put up a parking lot and make way for new student housing. We'll be revisiting that audio piece in a moment. The organizers and community dedicated to saving Sunflower House are hosting a public forum on March 1st from 6 to 7 p.m. at Sunflower House, located at 128 Northwest 9th, on campus, to talk about goals that ensure meaningful participation in community decisions that impact the lives and neighborhoods of those living near the Literacy Center. The forum will also address whether OSU's decision makers have lived up to university policies meant to guide development processes. Donations going towards the Sunflower House will be welcomed. KBOO's Zelos Marchant spoke with organizers from the group Save CMLC last year about university policies undermining CMLC's relationship with OSU's programs.
Well, Valerie George, thank you so much again for taking the time to talk to me and our listeners about what is taking place in Corvallis. Do you want to tell our audience about what CMLC is and what's happening between that community center and OSU?
I will. Thanks. Thanks so much for having me on. The Corvallis Multicultural Literacy Center, also known as CMLC, is a community-based nonprofit learning center which is situated right on the corner of Oregon State University land, and it's been a bridge between the university and the city for the last 12 years. And it's in a historic building, an old house that was built 107 years ago, always painted yellow, so it's always been known in this community as the Sunflower House. And currently, OSU has plans to demolish it because they are building more student housing and then adjacent parking, and so they need that space there, they believe, to build the housing and the parking. And what our community effort, which is called Save CMLC, is trying to convince the university to build around the Sunflower House and actually use it as a model for the way that they design the student housing, and so that it has a friendly interface between Corvallis and the university, which is part of the agreement between the university and the town, that that it would interface well together.
I remember there was a planning committee, and had the pleasure of listening to that, where there was much speculation about the size of the parking lot and whether that would be possible to have the dorm structure built around that. What kind of advancements came out of that planning meeting thus far? I think that was early June it took place.
I'm not sure where the planning's at now. I do know that the building itself, the Sunflower House, and the adjacent parking only takes up 5% of that lot, which is going to be developed. There's also trees that are protected, and there's also some kind of wetlands issues, so it's not as if all of that land is usable, but I know they're looking at different possibilities, and I think maybe what it's going to come down to for the university is if it's more financially sound to demolish the building and build, or to build around it. So I think that's what they're assessing right now, because there's, of course, costs contained in either way you go. And we've been working, our Save CMLC group has been working with Restore Oregon, which is based out of Portland, and they have quite a bit of data about the environmental impact of demolishing a building of that age, just because of the materials. Oftentimes at that age, the really high quality materials that were used to build it, it's still a very structurally sound, sturdy building. Everything that's contained within it, and then the demolition, the impact on the environment of any demolition, they say to recuperate all that is lost is about 50 years. So we've been working with them on this, and different environmental groups and all different kinds of community organizations, including the neighborhood association that would be greatly impacted by 300 to 400 students in a single lot at a very busy intersection in the middle of a town, and then their cars as well.
I understand there's been a long-standing partnership between the Sunflower House and OSU. How many programs from OSU, or I should say probably students, use Sunflower House? What kind of programs does Sunflower House host?
Oh, right now, as the multicultural center, it's a pretty wide variety, because if you're just talking about undergraduate students, there's lots of internships and different ways that the students use the center, including that there's 4,000 international students right now at OSU. And for some of the students, they participate in the INTU program on campus, which is quite costly. And then a lot of the students, like particularly we've been working with the Iranian students, most of them do not come from wealthy families, and they're not supported by wealthy governments. And so they're here on their family's dollar, and so they can't really afford the very high-priced English classes and courses that are offered through the M2 program. And so they take advantage of the free English classes and conversation circles at the Multicultural Literacy Center. And it's also a way not just to have classes and improve their English, but actually to have partnerships. So like through the CMLC right now, there's over 200 active partnerships, and that's between someone who wants to learn a language and someone who is happy to help tutor someone in a language. And a lot of times it's people wanting to learn or practice their English, but sometimes it's someone from the community wanting to learn German. So they find someone, sometimes a student from OSU who can tutor them in German. So there's all different opportunities like that, but then there's a whole other segment of the population at OSU, which is visiting professors and researchers and those people, and visiting scholars. There's over 550 of those people who have come from all over the world, and they oftentimes bring their families. And so nothing that's offered at OSU is extended in those ways to their families. So like many times a visiting scholar will bring their wife or husband and their children, and the wife begins to take English classes at the CMLC, she can bring her children with her. The classes are free. The partnership she ends up getting, the conversation circles are all free to her, but also there's free childcare. So her children can be there. She can take a class. And then what oftentimes happens is that she then will end up turning around and teaching a skill that she has, which can be, you know, anything, but oftentimes it's cooking. And so the center was really set up to be a living room of learning, and everyone who comes there is both a teacher and a student. So it's not a one-way street. It's very much a reciprocal thing. And it gives people, I would say that 75% of the people from other countries who use the center are women. And so this is oftentimes their first connection with the United States, their first connection with Oregon and with Corvallis. So this is their entryway into the community.
Hmm. How can people get involved with Saving Sunflower House?
We have, we have a Facebook page, Save CMLC. We're developing a website. You can also go to the CMLC.org website or CMLC's own web Facebook page. People could, I think that that's the best way is through social media and through the website. I would say that right now we're working on several different fronts, but we've been collecting petition signatures, and we have an online change.org petition, which is also Save Corvallis Multicultural Literacy Center, and it sends emails to the Ed Ray, who's the president of OSU, and to the OSU Board of Trustees, because they would be the ones who would make the decision about saving the center. They have been very generous, and we always want to recognize that, because 12 years ago, when the people who started the CMLC had this vision that they wanted to create this center that was the whole world in a house, and they had an idea of what they wanted to do and how they wanted to connect the people in the community with the people coming to our community who don't speak English, whether they're immigrants or refugees, and the international students. And so they approached the university and then negotiated a deal with them. They took the building over, which was slated to be demolished 12 years ago and was all boarded up, and they did all the renovations. They have assumed the liability. They've maintained the place and made it an incredibly beautiful, interesting 14-room, very vibrant center. And in